Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A wave of Chinese imports has dramatically driven down the cost of clothing in the past few years. First, their knitwear hit America's low price racks, then underwear and nightgowns, then nearly everything you wear. Domestic clothing manufacturers have been lobbying hard to try and stem the tide. Despite their work, the last big barrier to an ocean of even cheaper Chinese sweaters, socks, and jeans will fall on January 1st. That's when the World Trade Organization lifts its current system of textile and apparel quotas. For decades, the U.S. has known protective restrictions on these imports. Soon, the floodgates could be opened, and the world's jobs and trade reshaped again. Tonight on Point, cheap clothes, China, and the ceaseless remaking of the global economy. You can join the conversation tonight. Has your wardrobe already been reshaped by cheap clothes from China? When all the quotas are finally off, will we be buying 99-cent blue jeans from Chinese factories? And what do you want, the rock-bottom price or economic stability? Does anyone have a choice anymore? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Robert Friedman, international editor at Fortune magazine. He recently edited a special issue called Inside the New China and regularly follows developments in global trade and the Chinese economy. Robert Friedman, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Good evening, Tom. I'm glad to know that we didn't get bumped by the Scott Peterson trial.
Scott Peterson will go one way or another, but we're looking at the big picture here, Robert Friedman. It's great to have you. I wish you'd lay out what's going on. We go out, we buy these clothes, and almost everyone has noticed in the last 2 years how unbelievably cheap so many articles of clothing have become and so many tagged made in China. Now we've got this January 1st change that's coming. And just as it's when all the gates are supposed to be open, just as it approaches, we hear all kinds of resistance, some sops thrown out by China in the last 24 hours. Washington's trying to bar the door again today. But can you take us back in this? What was this huge system of quotas that we've been operating within, and what was or is supposed to come off on January 1st?
Okay, that's a long story and a complicated story, Tom. I think we need to start off with a larger context that over the last 20 years or maybe even a little less than that, China has become a huge manufacturing platform, not just for apparels, but for many, many products, electronics, toys, furniture.
You name it, almost everything at some days, it seems.
And there are reasons for this, and they have to do, among other things, with China's almost inexhaustible supply of cheap labor, with its managerial and manufacturing skills, with its infrastructure, which is quite good, and with just the economic system and stability that they have been able to create as China has grown into a increasingly significant world power.
Incredible economic growth, the world's workshop at this point.
Absolutely, and this has been great for China. It's it's created a rising middle class there of hundreds of millions of people who have come out of poverty, come out of rural environments where they've been eking out livings, and have in a position now where they too can buy the same clothes and television sets and refrigerators and cars that Americans have long taken for granted.
It may not seem quite as cheap to them as they do here, but meanwhile, they've been pushing all this, and for all the amazing volume of Chinese clothing we've seen, just to take that category, it's only a fraction of what China could be exporting. It's been held back by quotas that date back to the 70s.
Let's focus just on the clothing issue. Since the early 1970s, the world has been living under something called the Multi-Fiber Agreement, which is controls through an elaborate system of quotas the amount of garments that can be shipped into the United States from various countries. At the time this agreement was reached, China was not a manufacturing center, and China was not even a part of the World Trade Organization in 1995 when the latest version and the current version of the quota system was agreed upon.
I mean, in the 70s, China was still a post-Cultural Revolution wreck.
Exactly so. So the world has changed at the same time that this this system has been in place. Mm. This country preaches, this country being the United States, preaches free trade, but often doesn't really follow it. And in the case of textiles, we have had this system which has prevented countries from shipping in garments. Now, what's happened in the interim is that because there's been a quota on garments coming in from China, manufacturers have developed manufacturing facilities in other countries, in Bangladesh, in Sri Lanka, in Mauritius, in many, many other countries.
They really spread it around because everybody had a piece of the big quota pie.
Everybody had a piece of the quota pie. So you had this artificial system which resulted in the apparel industry in each of these countries growing quite strong.
And that explains this weirdness, Robert Friedman, of why you've got made in almost every obscure little country in the world, it seems sometimes.
Absolutely. And you can go around the world just in a Gap store and looking in the labels and T-shirts.
Sri Lanka, Burma, you name it.
Now, on December 31st, this whole system of quotas will get lifted as a result of an agreement reached through the World Trade Organization, actually reached in 1995.
Right.
There was a 10-year phase-out of these quotas. Let's remember that that for all the flood of goods from China, only about 17% of the apparel that is exported into the United States comes from China right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest comes from all these other countries.
You've got Mexico and Hong Kong and Taiwan, the Philippines, right on down, Bangladesh,
right.
Thailand.
Now, when this when the quotas are lifted, the speculation is that the percentage of U.S. apparel coming in from outside the country could rise to 50% from China.
Wow, almost triple.
Almost triple. So the expectation is that it's a pretty significant increase, and that many of the retailers and manufacturers, the Gaps and the Walmarts of this world, instead of manufacturing in 40 different countries because of this quota system, will reduce their sites to maybe a half a dozen countries, and China will be the big beneficiary of that because their system is not—it's not only just cheaper, but they have invested lots of money in technology, in building factories, and these are not sweatshops. These are modern, clean, productive factories that China has developed.
So a huge ripple through effect. And I mean, it's partly just what we buy off the shelves, what ends up in our closets and drawers. But we picked up this as a kind of case study tonight because it shows how these global economic winds just blow people all over the place.
Well, and there are winners and losers. I mean, the American consumers in general will be winners here because prices of garments and T-shirts and jeans will be lower. There's an expected something like $3 on a $10 pair of jeans. The cost of manufacturing is $10. An extra $3 is added on because of this quota system. If that money is passed along to American consumers, which maybe it will be, or maybe it'll wind up on Walmart's bottom line.
Right.
That could be good for consumers. It'll also be good for people in China. I mean, again, you're going to have a growing factory class, more jobs for people in China. And it'll be bad for some factory workers, textile workers in the United States, no doubt. Now, I think, Tom, that it's important to sort of not engage in fear-mongering here because although the quota system is coming off, there still exists a tariff system. The United States is allowed to impose tariffs on garments that are coming to the United States, and does, sometimes as high as 30%.
Right.
As you pointed out at the top of the show, China just on Sunday night agreed that they will impose their own export tariffs on garments leaving China.
So they won't become quite so cheap to sort of hold down the flood, if you will,
exactly.
at least a bit. But they didn't say how much.
They didn't say how much, and I think there's still many questions to be answered. But I think what it signals is that it's not in China's interest to immiserate its trading partners. China wants to grow its economy, but it does not want to do so at the expense of the economies of other countries, including the United States.
And yet it could, and big things are happening here. Big wheels are turning. Robert Friedman, it's so good to have you. I want to bring another voice into this conversation.
Sure.
From Chicago tonight, Ron Sorini is with us. He's president of trade negotiations and legislative affairs at the law firm Sandler, Travis & Rosenberg. They handle trade issues for Walmart, the maker of Wrangler jeans, and others. He was also a U.S. leader in World Trade Organizations to end the textile quotas in the 90s. Ron Sorini, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Pleasure to be here, Tom.
So here we are coming up on this big January 1st date that you were part of setting all those years ago. Now it's about to arrive, and you're on another side of the table representing Walmart and others. How do the different players look at what's unfolding here, Ron? Who welcomes this? Who dreads this? How does it play out?
Well, of course, when we were negotiating this 10 years ago, we didn't think it would come as quickly as it did, and there were a lot of people in denial that the U.S. would actually relinquish the quota system that had been in place for really over 40 years.
Yeah.
But certainly the retailers are see this as a tremendous opportunity to consolidate their manufacturing and their importing. And as the other guest said, if you look a year down the road, Walmart will probably be buying from 5 or 10 countries instead of 40. So it will reduce their cost because it's very costly when the buyers have to get on planes to 40 or 50 different countries and try to create consistency of product in so many different countries. So the system will become much more efficient.
Now, we're also seeing here that retailers plan to deal with the lower prices that they'll eventually get out of this in different ways. Some will pass a lot of that on. A lot of retailers in the United States will just pocket that extra, that savings. High-end retailers in particular, but maybe even Walmart talking about pocketing some of that. So not all of this will go straight into consumer savings in the United States, Ron. Am I right?
Well, it's a very competitive marketplace, though. I think certainly the retailers will want to capture some of the increased revenue, but whatever Walmart, however they price a good, someone else is going to price it a little lower to try to get more market share. So I think a good bit is going to end up in the consumer pocket.
So those 99-cent blue jeans we're half joking about, but prices on many pieces of clothing are so low already by American standards. This is getting into a kind of it almost seems crazy sometimes what you can buy for $3 or $4 at the store.
It is pretty incredible, but as I said, I don't think we've seen anything yet. I mean, this really is a pretty seismic event. I mean, it's been 40 years since we've had a quota-free environment, and China is not the only source of low-cost, efficient labor. We have India and Pakistan and Bangladesh and Sri Lanka and many other countries. So the effects over the next couple of years is going to be pretty dramatic.
And, Ron, you've seen this from different sides of the table. Do you feel confident? I mean, you're working for Wrangler and Walmart and others, but do you feel confident in your heart that this is all going to work out for everybody? Is this good for Americans in the long term? And what about the rest of the world if all this manufacturing gets concentrated in a few big manufacturers? What happens to Americans? And then what happens at the other end of the scale to Indonesia, the Philippines, Costa Rica? How's it play out?
Well, clearly there's going to be some adjustments. But to answer your question, yes. In my heart, I clearly believe this is the right thing to do for the American consumer and the American people. When we started the negotiations, we really started this in the Reagan administration and continued on in the first Bush administration. And we had felt we were giving manufacturers here in the United States ample time to prepare. It was pretty clear by 1991 the quota system would go away, and now it's 2004.
Yeah.
So domestic manufacturers have had 13 years to prepare for this. But it's going to create more efficiencies. American producers, many of them were less efficient because they hid behind protection. They were not innovative. They did not adopt the most efficient manufacturing process. So many of them will survive, and many of them will be better for the competition they're going to be facing. And there's going to be opportunities, let us not forget. These trade agreements are giving us opportunities in foreign markets.
Ron Sorini, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Ron Sorini joined us from Chicago. He's with Sandler, Travis, and Rosenberg. Robert Friedman, would it have been, is it now really possible for American apparel makers, textile manufacturers, to compete with these incredibly low-cost Chinese competitors?
Let's not forget, Tom, that there is still an apparel industry in my hometown, New York City, and
yeah,
there's one in Los Angeles. And they exist here because clothing manufacturers, in addition to wanting low costs, also need flexibility and quick turnaround time.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes about 18 days to get a product from China to a department store in Dallas, Texas, maybe a little more, because Dallas is not on the coast. If you're selling a hot garment at some store here in the U.S., you can go to a garment factory in New York and get this turned around in maybe 48 hours.
Get it turned around in a hurry, and yet out there, all that transport and all that productive power. Robert Friedman with Fortune Magazine, we're so glad to have you tonight. Stick with us. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about China, cheap clothes, and a rapidly changing new global economy. You can join the conversation. Have super cheap clothes changed your buying habits, your wardrobe? Where are we headed here? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about China, about cheap clothes, and about a global economy changing at an unbelievable pace. January 1st, a lot of quotas come down. It's been a flood of clothing from China. It could be, well, the whole ocean could come rolling in. Many people trying to bar the door right now. Not everybody happy about it, but these winds of change are blowing, and they're blowing hard. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you seen how China drove down clothing prices in the last 10 years, and can you imagine them plummeting yet again, really further? Have those super cheap clothes changed your buying habits, your wardrobe, and can you imagine a world where almost all clothes, or a huge percentage, were made in one country, China? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by Robert Friedman. He's international editor at Fortune magazine. We're joined now from New York by Mark Levinson. He's chief economist and director of policy for Unite Here. The labor union formed last year when the union, formerly the Union of Needle Trades, Textile and Industrial Employees, joined with Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union. Unite Here, over 440,000 active workers in the textile and hospitality trades, the country's largest union for textile and apparel workers. Mark Levinson, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
So here comes the new deal, the new setup, and it's China with a much more open door. Not clear exactly what's going to be held out and what's going to be coming in, but clearly moving rapidly toward big change here. What does this mean for American textile workers, and is it just the way of the world, the way of the global economy, Mark Levinson, that this is where we'll go, and that's that?
Well, first of all, it's not inevitable that this happened. This is a question of policy, and for U.S. textile and apparel workers, this is a catastrophe, and it's a catastrophe for apparel and textile workers almost everywhere in the world, except for perhaps China and maybe one or two other countries. We estimate that up to 500,000 U.S. apparel and textile workers will lose their jobs within a few years of the ending of the quota system, and millions, tens of millions of workers in developing countries around the world will lose their jobs when apparel and textile quotas end.
But this is what the World Trade Organization was supposed to encourage, isn't it? That we would all buy from the lowest cost manufacturer on the planet, and the world would be a completely efficient, humming economy.
Well, the question is that really a viable vision? And what I think this calls into question is the costs, the downside to implementing that is just enormous. And we are, as some of your previous guests have pointed out, in just a matter of days will be the first time in decades that the global apparel and textile industry has not been under some form of regulation. As I said, as a result of that, millions of people around the globe in some of the poorest countries in the world are going to lose their job. A UN study, for example, estimates that in Bangladesh, 1 million Bangladesh apparel workers are projected to lose their jobs when quotas expire. Bangladesh is one of the poorest countries in the world. They can't afford this. Just like 500,000 apparel and textile workers in the United States cannot afford to lose their jobs when apparel and textile quotas disappear.
Robert Friedman, there at Fortune, you're pretty big free traders, but you hear the voice of labor here in the United States and talking about elsewhere around the world as well, saying, you know what, this is a catastrophe.
First of all, I don't think it's true that we're left naked here and defenseless. We have, although the quota system is being removed, there is still a tariff system. There is still a mechanism whereby if a segment of the garment industry claims and can establish that there's market disruption, that the Commerce Department can impose a backdoor agreement that has that exists in, and has been done already now with socks and bras and a few other categories.
The Bush administration is saying today that, it will do this, but it's not forever.
Which will limit the growth of Chinese imports to 7.5% a year.
Mm-hmm.
That system can continue till 2008. So we're not being left naked here, and we're not being that we're going to see the devastating kinds of job loss that fast and that big that Mark has talked about.
Mark Levinson, are you comforted by the steps that that Washington has taken today, no doubt in response to manufacturers and maybe to your group as well?
Yes, no, we are involved in supporting the safeguard petitions. The safeguard process is desperately needed. It's a kind of Band-Aid, you know, patchwork, short-term approach that could limit some of the immediate damage, and it's desperately needed, and we support it, and we hope the administration does implement it, which they should. It was part of the agreement with China. It is not a substitute for a more comprehensive solution to this problem. If I could just say a word on the tariffs, that tariffs are not going to save us here. For example, a number of goods already came off quota in 2002.
Yeah.
And it's very instructive to look at what happened with those goods. And tariffs still exist on those goods. In those goods, before quota went off, China's market share in the U.S. was 9%. The most available figures show that in those goods, just 2.5 years after quotas came off,
yeah,
China's market share is over 70% of the U.S. market.
It goes and it grows. Mark Levinson, stand by. Robert Friedman, I want to begin to bring our callers in here. Ali is calling from Boston. Hi, Ali. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me there?
Loud and clear.
Okay. I just wanted to point out another aspect on this issue, and that is, we're missing a huge point on the strategic stand with China. I mean, we are creating a superpower, and just looking at it as the consumer, what's good for the American consumer, and we're not paying attention to the impact that's going to have on the world politics.
Do you welcome this superpower, Ali? Are you welcoming it?
No, I'm not. Are you kidding me? More than 500,000 people losing jobs in the United States.
But you know, Ali, that the U.S. Said to China over the last couple of decades, you need to move toward free markets and toward democracy, and they go hand in hand.
Yes, that's what we think, or that's what we thought. But look at Saudi Arabia. They're making $100 billion export each year, and where is the democracy in Saudi Arabia? If that's the money, if the problem is money, look at that country. What happened to democracy there? So how can we say the same model is going to work in a communist regime? A communist regime.
We got it, Ali. Thanks very much for your call. Robert Friedman.
If I could just make a larger point here.
Yeah.
I think if we look at this only in the context of textiles, we're missing the larger picture here. Part of the WTO agreement and part of what's going on in global trade right now is that countries like China are being forced to and are agreeing to open up their doors to Western companies. Today, there was an announcement that China was going to open its, you know, itself wider to outside insurance companies coming in.
Mm-hmm.
We sell everything in China from Kentucky Fried Chicken. There's something like 1,000 franchises just in China. We sell machinery to the textile factories that are opening up in China. We will sell them cotton. We will sell them many, many things, whether it's cans of Coca-Cola or other American products that will benefit the American economy. So this is not just China stealing our jobs and stealing our textile apparel.
So let them grow and let the whole thing work. Marianne's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Marianne. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess my comment is, as a consumer that would like to be supporting my local economy,
yeah,
even in trying to purchase retailers that I typically identify with being within the U.S. and even within Wisconsin. Lands' End is my perfect example. Even in their Christmas catalog, all the products are coming from other countries. So any advice for the consumer who's trying to buy clothing and happy to pay more money for it, but wants to support the U.S. economy and even actually the state of Wisconsin and our local economy.
But it may be tough to do. Mark Levinson, Marianne, thanks for your call. Mark Levinson, how about it? Marianne wants to buy American. It's tough to do it.
Well, it increasingly is, and I think it's very important for consumers to tell retailers, to let them know that they think this is an important issue. And, you know, let's make no mistake about this. The main beneficiary of what we're talking about tonight is the retail industry. They want the right to, you know, be able to go anywhere with the fewest regulations. And, you know, we talk about free trade in China. It's worth remembering, for workers in China, there is no freedom. Labor rights are brutally suppressed in China, and it's one thing to talk about the freedom of our companies to go there and produce, but they're complicit with a government and with a system in China that brutally suppresses worker rights. And it's important for consumers to let retailers know that they don't like that.
But the National Retail Federation, just in the last couple of days, pushing Washington hard not to put new quotas on here because they want to bring in these products. They say their customers want them. It's quite a picture. Mark Levinson at Unite Here, Chief Economist and Director of Policy there. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We are joined now from Washington by Brenda Jacobs. She's Washington Staff Counsel for the U.S. Association of Importers of Textiles and Apparel. The group represents a lot of U.S. importers of textiles from around the world. Members include department stores like Macy's, Filene's, Bloomingdale's, many brand-name clothing designers. Brenda Jacobs, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
So how do you look at this whole issue? January 1st, there's been anticipation in some quarters and stark fear in others that the floodgates would really be open from China. Lots of product and lots of great bargains for American consumers. Your group wants those gates open to bring those products on in. Is it an unmitigated good thing for the U.S. in your view?
It is a good thing, and the retailers are looking for it and the importers are looking for it as a way of finally joining the mainstream.
Which mainstream?
Like all other importers of consumer goods, we can finally operate under normal trade rules instead of the discriminatory rules under which we've been operating.
So you're saying the same as people who are importing cameras or, stereo systems or you name it?
Exactly. We've been under a separate system that has regulated our market, limited our options, forced us to spend a lot more money and a lot more time trying to find new sources of supply each time one gets cut down because of a new quota.
And that because textiles and apparel have been so surrounded by quotas for so long.
Right, and every time we developed a new source of supply, a new quota was imposed.
So how do you look at this? Do you see this as a boon for the bottom line of your members or as a big price savings in the offing if the doors are really open for consumers or both?
It's actually a good saving for consumer. It also offers them real choice. And I think a lot of the savings will be passed on. For many companies, they see this as an opportunity to, instead of paying quota charges, which is where a lot of the cost has been, to improve the quality and inputs. For example, in infants' wear, they've been embellishing the product more, and many of the companies look forward to doing that.
Of course, I'm looking here at a Bloomberg report talking about how a lot of retailers would pocket the savings when the China trade quota is in.
I think that was discussed a little earlier when Ron Serini spoke, that there's a limit to how much one can pocket. I think the goal for many companies is to try to offer more for the same dollar. For example, I know companies have talked about the ability to offer finer sheets, 450-count sheets, where they were previously offering 250-count at the same price point.
Mm-hmm. So better quality, same price point. Kevin's calling from Boston. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. First, I'm a consumer, and I also work in the apparel industry.
Okay.
And I started out a decade ago working with domestic manufacturers. I guess I've been amazed to watch the jobs pour out of the country, and I question the methodology or the, I guess, perceived notion that lower prices somehow mean savings for the American public.
Well, it should mean that, shouldn't it? What do you mean, Kevin?
Well, you either pay now or you pay later. You know, just because apparel imports are cheaper, what happens to the U.S. labor market as it loses its decent-paying jobs, its living wages jobs, to countries that don't have any sort of collective bargaining rights? Or, you know, we're outsourcing. We're talking about outsourcing to China, and not one Chinese citizen has the right to free association to form a labor union to negotiate a fair wage.
Kevin, stick with us. Brenda Jacobs, how do you answer that? Your retailers want to bring in those low-cost items, and we've seen lots of people snap them up and buy them, but Kevin raises this issue of quality of life, labor rights, and so on. How do you look at that?
But this isn't just about price. This is about choice, about being able to provide the best quality product. So I reject the notion that this is all about price and that prices are going to be that China's prices are that low either.
But he's not looking at just the thread count in the sheets or what's embellished on the infant clothing. He's looking at wages, at working conditions, and he's saying that Americans are going to pay in the end, in his view, if they're nose-to-nose competition with a country that doesn't really allow labor organizations.
If you look at the corporate codes of conduct under which all of the retailers and importers operate, in which they demand that the companies with whom they do business comply with, you'll recognize that we're actually spreading our values around the world, not lowering our values or lowering standards.
Kevin, what do you say, American retailers spreading their values and standards to China?
I would guess that every panel member here has talked about their point of view, and obviously they're getting paid by someone to offer this point of view. But the truth of the matter is that these sweatshops exist, and the people who make money from these sweatshops are not giving it back to their workers, and it's pretty obvious. I mean, if you do a simple web search on sweatshops today, you'll learn the system. It's outsourcing by private label brands like the major retail market brands to contractors who then place production in sweatshop facilities, and the workers, the actual workers, don't get paid that money.
Kevin, we've got it, and we thank you very much for your call. Brenda Jacobs, a last thought on that. A lot of skepticism there from the consumer calling in that American retailers are really going to police global labor conditions.
I really think it's unfortunate that we end up with accusations rather than looking at what's really the benefits of how hard we've worked and how much time has been provided to industries to adjust. And more time may be necessary and more steps may be necessary to help industries adjust, but that doesn't mean that we should maintain market regulation that's really not in the interest of promoting trade around the world.
So bring on the free trade, you say. Brenda Jacobs, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Can I jump in here for a second?
Yes, please. Robert Friedman.
I think it's only a matter of time before wages start rising in China, working conditions improve. Yes, there are lots of problems there, but I'd like to remind Kevin, if he's still listening, he said he was from Boston. It wasn't 100 years ago that most of the apparel manufacturing and textile industry in the United States was located in the Northeast.
And then shoes until just 40 years ago.
Jobs left town, they went south. They went south because there were no unions down there, because labor was cheaper, and the unions followed them. Labor conditions improved, wages rose, and now the world is turning again.
And that volume of change just gets cranked up. Robert Friedman, stick with us. We have to take a short break here. We're talking about China, cheap clothes, and a rapidly changing new economy. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about China, cheap clothes, and a world economy changing like nobody's business. You can join the conversation tonight. Does America's textile industry deserve protection against the Chinese juggernaut? And what about Bangladesh's industry, Sri Lanka's? Has China already taken over your wardrobe? and what is emerging from this whirlwind of global economic change. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight, and happy to be so, by Robert Friedman, international editor of Fortune magazine. Right now, Paul is calling from Nahant, Massachusetts. Hello, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
Look, I've heard the argument made that there's a balance here between increasing Chinese access to U.S. markets and increasing access for U.S. companies in China.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, as if it's a one-to-one equation, as if all of China benefits and all of America benefits.
Well, I don't know if anyone suggested it's one-to-one at every moment, but that overall that's the dynamic that's been described, yes.
Well, that is a dynamic, but let's look at the details.
Mm.
And what you're seeing here is essentially a massive transfer of wealth, because the people in America who will make money are those people who manage and invest in the large companies that benefit.
Mm-hmm.
The people who will take it in the neck are the American workers who will lose their jobs by the tens of thousands.
Why shouldn't they be working for the American companies who ultimately export to those more affluent citizens or consumers in China?
Wait a minute, Tom, we're not talking about exporting tremendous volumes of goods. The argument was made that we're going to be exporting services, and we've already seen what happens when American companies in the service sector expand. They outsource as much of that service as they possibly can. They hire people, once again, at lower wages in foreign companies, in foreign countries, in order to improve their bottom line.
And we've seen that it's true, whether it's IBM or a whole lot of other corporations. Robert Friedman, how do you answer this? You know, it is that tough question, because these are not one-for-one deals, and you can't always draw a straight line. And here Paul's calling, and he's skeptical about the whole ratio he sees. A vast transfer of wealth, period.
Right now, there is a huge imbalance of trade in China's favor between China and the United States. There's no doubt about that. That is where our deficit of trade comes from. But I would like to point out that the world is changing. Most of the jobs that have been lost in the United States have not been lost because they've been taken offshore. They've been lost because of technology, productivity gains through technology. You can't stop that, although jobs are being lost. And you can say, yes, it's terribly dislocating and people are suffering because technology has resulted in workers being laid off. Okay, but this is the way the world progresses. The same thing with globalization. There is a shift in the way manufacturing is done, and you now have these global supply lines. But the upside of it is...
Paul can't see the upside. Paul's saying the upside is not clear.
I'll get to it. The technology and the skills that American companies, particularly in the technology sector, offer the world, all those people who are running call centers and offshoring jobs in India and
now doing R&D in India and China.
HP computers are buying technology that is manufactured in the United States. Are drinking our sodas and wearing our clothing. Yeah, sure, it's manufactured in China, but this could be and should be good for the United States, which will have to learn how to compete, where to compete, and compete from its strengths.
And yet, oh boy, you feel the skepticism in the meantime. When we look at those, at the trade figures, and they surely do run a lot of money going the other way. I want to get one more guest in here tonight from Washington joining us, Augie Tantillo. He's executive director of the American Manufacturing Trade Action Coalition. They represent 200 manufacturing companies across the U.S. They have lobbied to maintain current trade restrictions on goods from China. Augie Tantillo, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're more than welcome, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what do you have shaping up here on January 1st? Have you barred the door enough to feel comfortable, or is this the ocean coming in? Are you guys finished?
Well, unfortunately, there's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done from our perspective. The decisions on the safeguards on textiles and apparel won't come until the end of January, 1st of February.
Right.
And so we, even if we get a clean win on those particular safeguards, there's going to be a number of categories that will be quota-free, and we expect the Chinese to overwhelm those markets in short order unless the U.S. government is able to negotiate a more comprehensive bilateral agreement with China moderating their exports.
But for right now, the Chinese are saying, look, we're only going to go so far here. You introduced us to this free trade game, and now we're playing it. Why don't you guys play it too? Joel is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Joel. You're on the air.
Hi. My question was what the experts feel about the notion that it's stabilizing to just to be, you know, let's say we're exporting jobs. In some way, isn't that good because we now have China dependent on us? And, you know, these are people who would otherwise be thinking America's awful, America's this, America's that. Now, you know, America's our biggest customer.
This is the way you weave the world together.
Exactly.
Joel, we've got it. Augie Tantillo, how about it? A strategy for world peace here. Put some of those factories in China. Have the buyers in the United States, and you've got a kind of fabric that won't want to rip.
Yeah, that's what Great Britain thought in the late 1930s. Their largest trading partner was Germany. We just need to realize that we are trading an enormous amount of wealth, sending it offshore. We had a $550 billion trade deficit in 2003. We're going to have over $600 billion in trade deficits this year. That's $1.5 billion of U.S. wealth every day that goes offshore, that's circulating through someone else's economy and not our own.
But, you know, the United States made the counter-argument when it was the up-and-coming power. How on earth can those other people justify not taking our goods? Our factories are so much more efficient. Our costs are lower. And that's how the U.S. built its wealth, isn't it?
Well, that's an excellent point. Are the Chinese more efficient? Actually, the U.S. textile industry is the most efficient and competitive fabric-producing sector in the world, yet it's being displaced by a less efficient textile weaving sector in China. And the reason that's happening is because China's manufacturers are benefiting from a state-run economy that subsidizes their production, gives them export rebates, provides them with loans that they do not have to repay, and then gives them the enormous benefit of an undervalued currency that allows for a 40% price break on everything they export.
And we've heard a lot about that in recent months. Robert Friedman, how about it? I absolutely hear the case that you're making, and it's textbook economic principles. But you live here, too, and look around. Do you ever wake up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night and wonder if your Fortune magazine theory is not working out in fact or not?
I do worry. I worry because I don't think America is competitive enough, and I don't think our educational system is strong enough, and I see us losing in the long term a lot of our competitive advantage that we have built up over the last 100 years. I think that what Augie is saying about the disparities in the Chinese system, there's much truth to it. I don't think it's an entirely level playing field. I think China is moving in the right direction. I think it wants to play by the fair WTO rules that have been imposed that affect all countries. And I think to espouse a position which relies on tit-for-tat, continued raising tariffs, raising quotas to fight back against perceived competition from abroad is not a sustainable, smart economic move. It'll cause even more imbalances on the other side. And ultimately is not the way to win. The way to look at this is that a job in China is no worse or better than a job in the United States, that economic growth in other countries is good for the United States.
But if the U.S. is competing, we've just got a minute left. Excuse me, Robert Friedman.
We can learn how to compete.
Yeah, I want to get one more word from Augie Tantillo here. How about it, Augie? It says, you know, this argument that the way to address this is not to keep throwing up tariffs, it's to change the competitiveness of American industry, the American workforce.
Well, what we have to accept is that we're not dealing with free market principles. The Chinese are operating under a different set of rules. And if we allow the largest manufacturing entity in the world when it comes to basic goods such as textiles, furniture, apparel, if we allow them to play under a slanted set of rules, they are going to displace millions of workers in the United States. along with millions of workers throughout the true developing world. And we have to ask, is that what we want?
Augie Tantillo for tonight. That's all we're going to get to do on it. But it's been eye-opening. We appreciate your being with us.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for having me.
Augie Tantillo, Executive Director of the American Manufacturing Trade Action Coalition. And Robert Friedman, this conversation is clearly going to go on. We appreciate your holding the torch high tonight there for that view. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Robert Friedman, International Editor at Fortune Magazine. This is On Point. Controversy over possible steroid use by baseball super slugger Barry Bonds is getting hotter by the day, and it's leading some people to ask if the man poised to break baseball's all-time home run record was pumped up by performance-enhancing drugs, what other great accomplishments might be the result of souped-up superhumans? Writer and satirist John Kenny takes the question into the world of advertising and wonders what if all those unforgettable commercials and jingles were created by steroid-popping copywriters.
Can you hear me now? Gut Milk? Home of the Whopper. Would it shock you to learn that the genius behind these taglines, these pithy mini-poems, these commercial haikus, was on performance-enhancing drugs at the time they were written? Well, he was, because he is I. I was a copywriter, an incredibly famous one. If by famous one means I had a job, I could walk into any agency in this country. And if I had an appointment, I was known. Look, there's John Kenny, someone who knew me would say. Or if they didn't know me, they might say, look, there's a guy with mustard on his face. The point is, I made a mistake. I took steroids, and I regret it. Which is why I'm cooperating with the authorities. Why I've named names. I regret naming some of those names because I made them up. Names like Gig Young, Dinah Shore, and Charles Lindbergh, not one of whom was a copywriter. Look, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. I told myself I was a powerful advertising mogul. But what I didn't tell myself was that I needed performance-enhancing drugs to write incredibly powerful commercials that changed the way consumers think and feel. Like the time I wrote the spot with the two strippers who get into a catfight over a Miller Lite by a hotel pool. How in heaven's name could I come up with that without steroids? What kind of difference do performance-enhancing drugs have on a copywriter? Consider the following tagline, written while I was juiced. Don't leave home without it. Now listen to what that line was like in the early draft stage, before the steroids. Don't leave your house or apartment or wherever you happen to dwell without wearing pants. Or checking to see that the stove is off, or taking a traveler's check, just in case you need it. And what of great moments from the past? Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Don't squeeze the Charmin. By Menon. What if we learn that Mabel, how about another black label, was conceived, written, and executed by men and women who were deeply enhanced, often by the lunch hour? Well, then we all lose. So what of life now? Well, since I've stopped taking performance-enhancing drugs, my body has undergone dramatic changes, and my ego has dwindled to near normal size. Sadly, I am unable to write an intriguing headline or TV commercial, but I have my life back, in the sense that I am working for a direct marketing firm doing pharmaceutical advertising, and so I'm not required to be creative. I'm also caddying on the side. So I say this, it's time to get the steroids out of advertising agencies. Will the creative work suffer? Most definitely. Will creatives themselves have a hard time finding other work? No question, as they're barely able to function in society as it is. But commercial breaks will again ring with spots created without performance-enhancing drugs. And most likely they'll be incredibly boring. But it's a small price to pay.
Writer and satirist John Kenny lives in New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.